Hi, I'm so excited to be here today with you. If you are a longtime listener of this show, and I'm talking 100 episodes ago, like the very beginning, where we had very, very expensive editors and truly excellent sound design, the good old days. But you know what? I don't think I was as much fun back then. I don't. In the first season of Under the Influence, I came up with a rule for influencing. I mean, who am I to come up with rules? But who is anyone to come up with rules for anything? I came up with this rule that was, if it exists in the world, there's an influencer for it. And I am constantly proved right. 4 years. That was 4 years ago. And since then, I really haven't found a thing that exists that there's not some kind of influencer for. So when I started researching my other podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance, the true crime podcast where I'm just going back to Sicily to solve my great-great-grandmother's murder with my children. I did a lot of genealogy research. And guess what? There's a genealogy influencer. In fact, there's many of them. But my favorite genealogy influencer by far is Krista Cowan. She calls herself the barefoot genealogist because what else would you call yourself if you were a genealogy influencer? Krista also works for Ancestry.com. She's been there since 2004, and she's been their corporate genealogist since about 2011. But she's also on the social media. She's on the Instagrams, being all barefoot. And this is how she describes herself. You may know me as the barefoot genealogist. I hate wearing shoes. But invariably, as I travel around the country doing genealogy research, I find that librarians and archivists don't love me running around their facilities in my bare feet. That's why it makes me so happy that every passing day brings more and more genealogy and family history resources online. She also says this on her website, which I love. Families are messy and always have been. I'm here to help you navigate the world of family tree building with confidence. Love it. There are some things that I do not think there should be influencers for, and this one seems pretty useful. So we're going to get into all of it with Krista today. I've cut out most of the parts where it's just me asking very annoying questions about my own family tree. Those are over on the Sicilian Inheritance podcast. But while I was editing that, I was like, oh my gosh, no, we have to do this kind of UTI crossover here because the influencing side of this, and also the side of this where the stories about our past and our ancestors, how those stories shape us and our identity, all of that is really powerful. So here she is. And you know what? She's not wearing shoes. I think you're one of the biggest genealogy influencers on the interwebs.
Yeah, probably. When I created this role, social media was still fairly new and Ancestry hadn't really leaned into that space. And so we started a YouTube channel and I started a series called The Barefoot Genealogist. And so then as other social media platforms just kind of took off, I was positioned because I was so much a face of the company to just do well in those spaces. So Facebook drew a lot of attention for the genealogy crowd. There are dozens and dozens of genealogy Facebook groups. I don't administer any of them because that's not the role I want, but I do serve kind of in an advisory capacity and I'm able to lean in and answer questions and people tag me into things and then kind of started up my own Instagram and have used that as a space to just explore some additional, just some additional ways to reach people and to educate people.
When Krista and I hopped on the phone, she'd just gotten back from one of the largest genealogy conferences in the world. Hundreds of thousands of people, sometimes millions, attend these conferences every year. And I think it's because we're all hungry for connection. We're hungry for stories that can help shape our identities in a world that feels crazy. I know that doing my own research for the Sicilian Inheritance podcast and finding out about my great-great-grandmother Lorenza's life and all of the other stories about my family, it changed me.
It changed how I view the world, how I move in the world. And I was so curious if Krista sees these transformations in people when they start this kind of research.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, I have a plethora of stories, but there are a few people who I have learned more about, some of whom I grew up knowing something about, but as I dug into their stories, my perception of them changed, which ultimately changed my perception of myself and changed the perception of how I move forward in the world and what my purpose is. And I find that with a lot of people, like there's one or two ancestors that just really resonate with them, or one or two mysteries to be solved that they become obsessed with, or there's always something for people to latch onto. But I think every one of us has something in us that just craves knowing more about who came before us and how we came to be who and where and what we are. And it's so influenced by the past, whether we are conscious of it or not, that when we become conscious of it, it has this power that is unexplainable almost. I wish I could explain how or why it happens. And I don't know. I just know that it does because I've seen it over and over and over again.
Yeah, I now believe that too. I was a non-believer before I did. Okay. But now I fully believe that these stories from the past, these stories about our ancestors, they have a real ability to shape who we are and how we move through the world in the present day.
Yeah.
So what are some of the craziest stories or interesting stories that you've learned about your own family's past doing this kind of work?
Oh, that's a great question. There are sad stories for sure, because history is messy. Yep. And families are messy, and families have always been messy. And all families are like, there's just like, that's just kind of the reality of the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And so there are stories that will break your heart. There are stories that will inspire you because of the resilience that they displayed in the face of really challenging things. I think that's probably the thing that resonates the most with me. I have an ancestor that I grew up hearing about my whole life, just kind of in random conversations with my mom. And it wasn't until I really dug into her life and understood the full scope of why it was so impactful to my mom as a mother to hear this story about this woman who was shipped off to America on a prison ship, essentially. And her indentureship was bought by a man who was a slave owner. And she was... He fathered two children by her non-consensually, and then she died. Like, that's it. Like, that's like, you think about it and you're like, that's her whole story. And yet you realize she lived long enough to come to America and to have two children. And those two sons who bear her name because their father would not give them his name, they are the progenitors of probably close to 50 or 60,000 people across the world now. And that's like, you think about, you put stuff like that in that kind of context, and it changes the significance of people's lives.
Wow. Wow. I just got chills hearing that, because with my family story, we have this story that, you know, a woman, our family matriarch, was murdered. And that's all that my family knew, that she was murdered before she could come over here to join her husband and sons. And my goal in all of this research was to not talk about her death, but to talk about her life. She lived a long time before this happened. What was her life like? Who was she? And I kind of hear the same thing in your story. You're like, well, she lived a long time. She had two kids. She made it across an ocean. But we don't talk about that. We don't talk about women's lives and women's stories nearly enough.
Right. I agree.
So what did you learn about her when you dug into things?
Yeah, it's interesting. So she was raised in this tiny little village in England in the 1700s, in a time when the Church of England had kind of a stranglehold on the culture. And she chose to leave that faith. She didn't choose to leave faith or to leave God. She just chose to leave that faith. And her parents disowned her and her community shunned her. And she ended up going to London to find work to support herself at 18 years old. And she found herself in some dire circumstances and made some poor choices, as all teenagers do, but without any kind of social or familial support system, those choices landed her in prison. And ultimately, she was sentenced to 7 years of indentureship in the colonies and shipped off. And then that landed her into a terrible situation with a man who was cruel and we suspect, though we don't have evidence yet, that she actually died in childbirth with a third child. She didn't live, in the scheme of things, she only lived into her, late 20s. But it was long enough.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, as a reporter, I have so many questions. And then as a novelist, I'm like, Krista, do we need to write this novel together?
Right?
Yes, 100% we do. Let me get this Sicilian inheritance out the door, and then we're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Peggy, Margaret Lawrence. I don't know. We've always called her Peggy in our family. I don't know if she ever used that name, but that's always the name in our mind when we talk about her. She left an impact. She left, just the little pieces of story that were shared. I mean, she's my 6 times great-grandmother. The little pieces of stories that were shared, you have to keep in mind, her sons were little when she died. Right. And they were essentially the property of this man who had fathered them. They, by the time they came of age, had to serve out the rest of her indentureship. I mean, the circumstances of their raising was also terrible. But someone on that property came to know her enough to tell them the stories enough that they were able to pass them on to their children and grandchildren.
Yeah.
And those stories just perpetuated, that tiny thread perpetuated until it got to my mom and her uncle, who cared enough about it to start digging into the story and figure out more of the truth. And then they passed it on to me, and I was able to find even more of the story. And I think it feels sometimes almost like she was just waiting to be discovered and waiting to have her voice restored to her and her story told.
Yeah. I feel the same way about Lorenza.
Yeah.
She was waiting for her story to be told. And in all of the ways, with the book, The Sicilian Inheritance, and now with this podcast. So, yeah. Wow. Wow. And lucky Peggy. Her great, 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 great ancestor happens to now be the barefoot genealogist.
Right.
Okay, we are going to take a very quick break here. And when we get back, we're going to find out how Krista got into this line of work in the first place. How does one become the barefoot genealogist? This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, and I am very much a parent, you have your fair share of big talks with your kids, especially if your kids happen to read your very adult novels because they're an advanced reader and you just can't rip it out of their grubby hands. But that is another story altogether. One of those big talks that you should be having is about money. I talk to my kids about money all the time, because it is something that my parents didn't talk about with me. Greenlight can definitely help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I have recently started doing an allowance for my 6-year-old, and he loves it. He also loves doing chores for money. I do not think that we can start them too early these days. And Greenlight makes it very easy for him to see exactly how much money he is making for which chores. It also helps my kids, even the four-year-old here, build financial literacy and independence by learning how to earn, save, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app also comes with an in-app financial literacy game called Level Up, that helps kids build money confidence through videos, bite-sized challenges, mini games, and more. More than 6 million parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices, and I am all in. I'm having a good time with it. I tried a lot of allowance apps, and many of them were very, very bad. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/influence. That's greenlight.com/influence to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/influence. And we are back with Krista Cowan, the barefoot genealogist, genealogy influencer extraordinaire. Because as I say all the time, there's an influencer for everything, my friends. I want to know a little bit more about Krista's own recent past. How does one become fascinated by genealogy and then actually turn that into a career?
Well, I came by it naturally. I had parents who very much cared about family narrative, like intentionally crafting a family narrative that made sure that certain stories were passed on and that information was delivered to their children at age-appropriate times, and that we were able to learn from those things. That was a really intentional thing on their part, which I so appreciate, and is something that I'm really passionate about families doing. I think sometimes we craft narratives in our family that make us victims. We craft narratives in our families that disempower us. And there are so many stories available to us to create and raise resilient, strong, self-assured children that just come from their own stories, the stories that literally are part of them and their very DNA.
Yes, yes, and yes. I can't wait for my kids to be old enough. I've got a 6, a 4, and a 1 to be able to really tell them these stories. But I also haven't shied away from it. I took them with me to Sicily last summer to solve this murder and told them exactly what I was doing and who we were investigating and what we wanted to learn. Because I think there's power in talking about this woman left alone for 12, 13 years. We recently discovered she bought her own land. I don't know if she was ever planning on coming. But, you know, there is power. And like you said, stories of resilience that I think are so important to the generations today, especially as I think a lot of us are searching for our own identities amidst the craziness of the world.
Yeah. And I think there's also, there's resilience to be found. I think there's also just some basic coping skills, right? Like we're raising this generation that is so susceptible to anxiety and to other mental health challenges. And there's a lot of reasons for that, societal reasons for that. But you know, Gen Z and Gen Alpha are two generations that measurably have more anxiety than any other previous generation. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we make life comfortable. Like we try so hard to avoid discomfort, to avoid hard things, to avoid consequences sometimes. And when you look to the past and all of its mess and madness sometimes, what you see is that they went through really hard things, and some of them made it out and some of them didn't, but all of them dealt with it in the best way they knew how with the tools that they had available to them. And I think there's something to learn from that.
There absolutely is. And I couldn't agree with you more. And little did we know that we would be giving parenting advice. But no, I completely agree. I think, you know, there is something about saying, they did hard things. You can do hard things too. I'm not going to shield you from the world, which is hard.
Yeah. And that it's in you, that is literally like, those are the people who made you. And there's something about that too.
And that is in your, literally in your DNA. Where does someone even start if they've got a story and a nugget? Where do you go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my genealogy career at owning my own genealogy research firm before I came to work for Ancestry. And I loved that. I loved being able to work with families. The challenge was oftentimes they would hand me the research and I would go away and do it and then come back and present it to them. And that wasn't nearly as satisfying as the work that I've found over the course of the last 20 years, which is here at Ancestry, I'm able to guide people on that journey for themselves. And I think just as much as I think that process of discovery is an important part of the process. And you've been through this now, so you kind of have a glimpse of that. Like that is part of the process is where the power lies. So yeah, if you've got a family story, the first thing I always tell people to do is just start with a family tree. right? Just sketch out on a piece of paper, or you can do it for free on Ancestry, or there's a million ways. Just start by sketching out your relationship to this person. Because for me, when I first heard the stories of Peggy, I had this like vague notion that it was my Granny Kerr's family. That's all I knew. But once I fully understood like the path from me to her, there was a tie. There was a, like a visceral connection. And so the family tree is the best way to start to sketch that out. And you do it with the best of your knowledge, but then you have to talk to your family members. And I think, again, sometimes that's something that in the messiness of families, we shy away from sometimes. You know, you may not have a great relationship with your mom, but call her sister or her first cousin, or reach out to, you know, somebody you once met at a family reunion when you were a kid. And maybe you can have a more candid conversation with them than with a parent or grandparent who sometimes are protective of their own stories. And when people start digging into the family history, get a little bit nervous.
Yes, I have encountered, you are describing my exact situation. Like this is, these are all of the things that have happened to me over the past year while I've been digging into this story.
Yeah, and it's funny, some people are all in and some people are so hesitant. And I think part of it has to do with just the way that certain things were viewed in the past. There were so many things that had so much shame attached to them, having a child out of wedlock, getting divorced. I mean, things that we wouldn't even blink at today that just carried so much shame and so much societal pressure. And so, you know, that older generation, when we start talking to those grandparents and great grandparents, if you're lucky enough to still have one or two of those around, like they're often hesitant. There's also a challenge sometimes with immigrant generations. You have immigrants who left the old country intentionally for whatever reason and wanted to leave it behind. And sometimes even when they came to the new country, dealt with a lot of shame around their identity. And so tried to shed that a little bit. And so when we start digging back into that identity as the grandchildren and great-grandchildren who are removed from that immigrant experience, it becomes a little bit triggering for them if they or their parents had worked so hard to put that behind them. So there's right. That barrier that comes up as well.
I don't know if my family wants me to refute the story that they have believed for so long. And I think that I will end up correcting it. And I don't think they're going to be happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. I mean, that's true of stories, kind of the way they get built up in families. It's also true of identities. I mean, the number one complaint, if you will, that we get here at Ancestry is people who take a DNA test and find out they are not Native American. And then they are just convinced the test is wrong. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands, who they have been raised with these stories of proud Indigenous ancestry, only to discover that it was just a story, that they don't actually have an Indigenous ancestor, but that someone started that story, or someone misunderstood something, or somebody's uncle married an Indigenous woman and the family took on that identity. And it really has become a part of people's identity in a lot of ways. And so sometimes when you start digging into family history, your identity, your perception of your identity shifts. Your identity always was what it was, but your perception of what it was or actually is often is confronted.
Yeah. So you start with the family tree, and then how do you start using the records to start building the story?
Yeah. So if you're starting here in the U.S. and working your way back, the magic year is 1950. So here in the United States, we take a federal census every 10 years. We've done that since 1790. Those census records, however, are protected by the government for 72 years. So the most recent publicly available federal census in the United States is 1950. It just came out 2 years ago. Every time there's a census release, it's a party around here. But that's the place you have to start. So you have to get your tree back far enough that you've got someone living in the U.S. in 1950 in order to dive into those particular records. And those census records are so rich in information and story. And as you start to string them together back to 1940, 1930, you start to get these snapshots every 10 years of the economic condition, of the family relationships, of the housing situation, of the occupations. Like this really like kind of lovely story starts to emerge. And it's also where you start to find some of the mysteries and the questions, right? Which is fun. But that census is where I always encourage people to start in the records because it builds a really good framework for building out and discovering the rest of the story.
And then from census records, where do you go from there? What is the next level?
Yeah. So then the next level is what we call vital records. So that would be birth, marriage, and death records. If the person died here in this country, oftentimes that death record or an obituary connected to that will give you details about that particular town in Italy or Ireland or Germany where they came from. And that you need that information because a lot of those other countries, unlike the United States, don't have national coverage of records. You have to know where in the country they came from so you can dig more into local records once you cross the pond. And so having that name of the place is a really important part of that process. And sometimes you get lucky with those death records or with the birth record of a child, for example, would list maybe the birthplaces of the parents. So those are vital records for a reason. And again, what you're going to see is just those snapshots. So you'll know kind of when the children age out of the home so that you've got a range of time to look for marriage records for those children. You'll know where they're living. Another really important record set here in the United States for making those connections in the old country is naturalization records. So when somebody became a citizen, it would be noted on the census if they chose to become a citizen or not. And if they did, that naturalization paperwork is so rich in detail. They had to file first papers, a declaration of intent to become a citizen. They had to list the names and birth dates of all of their family members and where they came from. They needed to list the ship they came over on and the date and the port. And then a few years later, they could actually petition for naturalization. And then you've got that paperwork, sometimes with a photo attached. So that naturalization paperwork is a big link and a big part of the story to see how they chose to, you know, make themselves a permanent citizen of this country or not.
We are going to take one more quick break here. And when we get back, there's a question that I've been dying to have answered ever since I started this research. And it's about women. It's about us. And it's about how our stories get lost and just how important it is for all of us to write down and share those stories so that we're the ones writing history. And we're back. So much of women's history gets erased because for a long time, it's been men writing history. It's been men writing history books. It's been men deciding which stories will get passed down through families. And when it came to my own great-great-grandmother's murder, we didn't know very much. In fact, most of my relatives didn't even know her name. They just knew that she was our family matriarch and that she was murdered, probably in a terrible way. There was no information celebrating her actual life, celebrating the fact that she had lived for 50 years, that she had had 7 children. We didn't know anything about what she was like. And there's just so many women like her, so many women whose stories we're never gonna know.
Is there a particular difficulty in finding records and tracing stories of women's lives, because it has not always been women who are writing history or who are the important actors in official documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're in a unique position because you're researching Italian families. And one of the benefits of Italian families over many other cultures is that most often the women retain their own surname. So you'll see that in the records. You'll see that in the passenger list when they're immigrating. Sometimes they often even chose to naturalize themselves. Here in the United States, prior to 1922, a woman derived her citizenship from her husband, which meant if she married a U.S. citizen, she gained automatic citizenship. If he became a citizen, she was grandfathered in under him. If she was born in the U.S., and was a citizen and married a non-citizen, she lost her citizenship. So there's like this really messy part of history where women were not included in the records and records were not created about them. But one of the things we see about the Italian women is that even prior to 1922, they wanted their own documentation. And so we see that that happen. But in most other cultures, you know, when we see immigrants from Germany, from England, from Ireland, and then some of the way that the women are or are not recorded in records in Canada and the United States, they do lose their identity. They lose their identity first because they get married and often take on their husband's surname. And if you're tracing your way back in history, unless one of those children specifically lists that in a birth or marriage or death record, their mother's maiden name, it can be really difficult to find her identity and connect her to her family of origin. And then property laws, I mean, property laws in the United States right up through the 1970s often meant that women couldn't have their own bank account. They couldn't own property without a man co-signing. And if there was an inheritance to be had, oftentimes that got passed on to her children or to a brother before it got passed on to her. And so, yeah, there is a dearth of identifiers of women in records for much of history.
I now feel like I am a part of this ever expanding family tree that now could really go on for quite some time. I was tracing the ancestors of my great-grandfather, Santo Piazza, Lorenza's son, but she had 7 children. So these are 6 other branches and rabbit holes that I can go down. I mean, do you find that people who are using Ancestry, it's just never ending?
Yeah, it's interesting. And when you think about it, like we're called Ancestry because most people want to climb up the family tree. Right? They're looking for the ancestors, your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. But then back in 2012, when autosomal DNA kind of burst on the scene and Ancestry started selling those kits, and that became this huge part of our business, what we were doing was we were connecting living people who share a common ancestor. So people started climbing back down the family trees looking for those descendants, right? And so, yeah, when you have families, particularly Irish or Italian Catholic families who have large numbers of children, or even my mother's Southern Baptist families from Arkansas, like you end up with so many people. I think my dad and I counted once. I think my grandmother has 98 first cousins. Like,
wow.
I have 9. That's all. 7 on one side, 2 on the other. Like, that's it. My grandmother had 98 first cousins. And so, like, And the further back you go, the more that number just exponentially grows. And so you have to kind of decide how you want to approach family history. And I think there's times and seasons for different things. I am currently in the middle of a descendancy project where I have identified a set of ancestors of mine, and I am tracing all of their descendants. The curiosity to see how a single couple and the choices that they made as part of their American frontier expansion west has affected the story of America is fascinating to me. And when you start looking at the exponential number of descendants and where they've all ended up in the world and the threads of commonality that we have even 4, 5, 6 generations later, and also the vast differences, I find it fascinating.
It's fascinating. I can hear this love in your voice and this passion in your voice. I could talk to you all day long, Krista. There's a reason you're the barefoot genealogist.
There is. I do love what I do. And I also just wish more people could catch the vision because, you know, as we started this conversation, we talked about the life-changing effects of family history. And I don't think it's just about us and how it affects us and how we change. But I also think there is healing to be found as we make those connections. People crave connection in the world today. And making those connections offers that. It offers perspective. It offers, I think, hope for the future as we can kind of just reconnect in some ways over some of those things. Because we tend to think in terms when we're doing family history research of families, but really it's networks of communities and tangential family relationships. And that holistic view gives you a clearer picture of who they were.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What is it like being a genealogy influencer? Are people constantly coming to you with questions? And is that overwhelming?
Yes and yes. That's the simple answer. But I love it. Like, that is my passion in life, is to help people understand the power of family history to change lives. And any way that I can convey that is energy giving, not energy depleting. And so yes, I'm constantly bombarded, and I do have to make sometimes hard decisions, and sometimes I don't get back to people as quickly as they would like me to. And some people get snippy with me, and I feel terrible about that. But I do know that I'm in a space and have the influence to help people in a way that has the power to change their lives. You know, it's funny because my dad has such negative opinions of influencers, and he called me that the other day, and I had to laugh because, you know, I'm not selling yoga pants or Stanley cups to people on Instagram. Yeah, right. I'm hoping that what I am opening their eyes to and their hearts to is the idea that there's an entire world full of people that they could be connected to, some in very real ways, and that there's an entire history. Ancestry helped produce a TV show years ago called Who Do You Think You Are? Mm-hmm. And at the end of one of those episodes, it was the episode with Tom Bergeron. He says this thing that just rings in my ears constantly. He said, "Someone who lived 300 years ago, if you're willing to listen, can teach you something about the life you're living today." And that's what I want people to know, is that there's such a vast opportunity to learn from the past in ways that will inform and direct our present and help us all together make the future even better.
We're going to end on that. Drop the mic, Krista.
I mean, I don't always get an ending as good as that, but yeah, fuck yeah. We are going to find ways to direct our present and help all of us together make the future even better. Yeah, we are. Mm-hmm. You can learn more about Krista at KristaCowan.com or follow her on the Instagrams at KristaCowan. I love telling women's stories. I love talking about women's stories. I genuinely love what Krista does, and I do think that stories about our past shape our identities today. They do. Thinking about Lorenza, thinking about her raising 7 children and then sending them across an ocean, not knowing if she was ever going to see them again. And frankly, she didn't see them ever again. It makes me think a lot about my own life as a mother, how I mother, and how I prepare my own children to go out and face the world. Thank you so much for being here with me today. If you love this podcast, tell a friend, leave us a review in all of the review places. And also, please listen to the Sicilian Inheritance True Crime Podcast, where I try to solve Lorenza's actual murder, but more than that, where I try to find out more about her life. I like to say that I start both the Sicilian Inheritance book, the book of the summer, and the podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance, with a dead body. The dead body of a woman, which we all know that our culture is completely obsessed with. But, neither of them end with one. And that's not a spoiler. It's not. Go have a great day. Tell one of your friends that they're doing amazing, and then go do something nice for yourself, because you deserve it. And it is Mom Week. We are getting a whole week this year. I mean, fuck, I want a whole month. Mm-hmm.